From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Overall, it appears to me that Mr. Tree relied upon Mr. Wu's foreign wire transfers to make his contributions to the DNC.
The FBI says a Clinton donor got more than $1 million from foreign sources. Landmines cause more U.S. casualties in Vietnam than any other weapon. And a crusading Colombian mayor speaks out against military repression. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Texas prosecutor says he'll present new evidence in a grand jury investigating the fatal shooting of the 18-year-old goat herder by a Marine patrol in Texas. District Attorney Albert Velazquez tells the Austin American-Statesman that he has more information than has been reported or is known by the military. Grand jurors in Marfa, Texas, are to decide whether a Marine corporal should be tried on criminal charges in the death in May of 18-year-old Ezequiel Hernandez. The Marine says he fired in self-defense after the teen shot twice with a .22 caliber rifle he used to protect his flock. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary William Cohen has suspended all military drug patrols along the Mexican border pending a review. Anti-smoking advocates said today the cigarette tax increase in the federal budget agreement will probably be only a small deterrent against teenage smoking. They also say the 15-cent tax hike to be phased in by the year 2002 does not necessarily presage more blows to tobacco when Congress takes up the proposed $368 billion nationwide lawsuit settlement, particularly since both houses of Congress last week defeated two other anti-tobacco measures. An environmental group today called for major U.S. chemical manufacturers to screen their products for toxicity, saying consumers have no information about the potential health risks of more than 70% of the most widely used industrial chemicals. Although everyone knows about the dangers of DDT and lead, the government and universities have no toxicity information on chemicals that are heavily used in everything from gasoline additives to zippers, this according to the Environmental Defense Fund. A not-so-private meeting last week has prompted new security moves by Republicans on Capitol Hill. House officials searched a meeting room in the Capitol for hidden recorders before a gathering of GOP lawmakers this week. Spokesperson says the search was part of a probe sought by Ohio Congressmember John Boehner. He wants lawmakers to feel free to speak their minds without fear their words might end up on tape. The security concerns were triggered by a meeting last week where Republicans vented their anger over an aborted coup against Speaker Newt Gingrich. Fox News obtained a recording of the supposedly secret session. This international news, 18 people were killed today when two explosions tore through a crowded outdoor market in Jewish West Jerusalem. Police said the attack was apparently the work of suicide bombers. The bombings within seconds of each other were by far the deadliest attack in Israel since Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's election 14 months ago. They occurred on the eve of a visit by U.S. Envoy Dennis Ross for talks with Netanyahu and Palestinian President Yasser Arafat on ways to revive their stalled peace process. Arafat condemned the suicide bombing. Turkish journalists protested in Istanbul today against the beating of their colleagues by police during an Islamist demonstration in Ankara. Around 200 reporters gathered outside the headquarters of the Turkish Journalists Association in Istanbul, shouting, "The free press will not be silenced." Five journalists were taken to hospital after being attacked by police and protesters as thousands protested against the secularist education plans yesterday. Robert West was executed last night by lethal injection in Texas. It was the 25th execution this year in Texas, extending a record for the nation's most active capital punishment state. The body of Joseph O'Dell arrived to be buried in Italy today, and Pope John Paul offered comfort to his widow. Although he had no Italian blood, O'Dell's case aroused overwhelming public sympathy in a nation which strongly opposes the death penalty. Italy's prime minister and president had joined the Pope in vain appeals for his life. A Vatican spokesperson said Lori Erz, who married O'Dell a few hours before his death by lethal injection, spoke privately with Pope John Paul after attending his weekly general audience. Rome airport officials said O'Dell's body arrived on a flight from Newark, New Jersey, and would be transferred to Palermo, Sicily, later in the day. O'Dell has been made an honorary citizen of the Sicilian capital, where he is due to be buried after a religious ceremony on Thursday. An action by the National Cancer Institute is sparking new accusations of a government cover-up. Watchdog groups are raising the conspiracy flag over the Institute's decision to indefinitely delay the release of some maps. The charts, which were to have been made public today, identified 24 regions that saw intense fallout from nuclear testing in the 1950s. The Cancer Institute has found that people as far away as the East Coast, especially children, were exposed to as much radiation fallout as were people directly downwind from the Nevada blasts. And the Virginia Court of Appeals has reversed a lower court ruling that barred the lover of a lesbian mother, Sharon Bottoms, from having contact with Bottoms' 5-year-old son. The appeals court ruled that the judge had erred in barring any contact between April Wade and Bottoms' son, Tyler Dustu, solely because of Wade's sexual orientation. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. At the Senate campaign finance hearings yesterday, Republicans delved into the wheeling and dealing of entrepreneur and former Little Rock restaurateur Charlie Tree. According to FBI agent Jerry Campaign, Tree laundered almost $1 million for an Asian tycoon. Tree started an international trading company called Daihatsu, but Campaign says the business never made much money and that given Tree's income, he couldn't have earned the $200,000 he donated to the Democratic National Committee. The DNC has returned all of Tree's money. FBI agent Campaign says that Daihatsu employees substantiate that the company barely broke even and was propped up by foreign cash.
Daihatsu records reveal that in January 1995, Tree made a pledge to the DNC to raise $350,000. Tree's Little Rock friends and acquaintances found it surprising to know that Tree raised substantial amounts of money as a national fundraiser for the Democrats. Ms. Schaffner and Ms. Jones both stated that they believe that Tree did not have the background or the ability for such a position, and that someone in Washington probably directed Tree's efforts. Schaffner and Jones suggested that that person might have been Mark Middleton. Tree left the United States earlier this year and is now reported to be living outside Beijing in China. It does not appear that Daihatsu was a profitable international trading venture. Tree claimed in a recent NBC News interview with Tom Brokaw that he earned $1 million in 1993. However, Daihatsu's corporate tax returns for 1992 through 1995 indicate that its gross income was never more than $250,000, his net income was negligible, and Tree's income as president of the company was approximately $30,000 a year. A review of Daihatsu's records and interviews with Charlotte Duncan, Daihatsu's bookkeeper, and Dewey Glasscock, Tree's accountant, further suggested that Daihatsu made little or no money at any time. Moreover, Tree and his wife had very little income from other sources. The bank records for accounts maintained by the three additional companies incorporated by Tree, they are San Kin Yip USA Incorporated, San Kin Yip International Trading Corporation, and American Asia Trade Center, indicate neither earnings nor any genuine business activity.
That's FBI agent Jerry Campaign describing Charlie Allen Tree's business venture, Daihatsu. What kept the U.S.-based company afloat, Campaign continues, were hundreds of thousands of dollars pumped in from a Macau millionaire named Eng Lap Seng, also known as Mr. Wu.
Despite the lack of any evidence of business activity, bank records for all personal and business accounts maintained by Tree indicate that from 1994 to 1996, Tree received a steady stream of funds by wire transfer from foreign sources, the bulk of which was wired from accounts maintained by Mr. Wu or companies that he controlled. Tree's bank records from mid-1994 through the end of 1996 revealed periodic wire transfers from Mr. Wu to accounts associated with Tree or one of his businesses, totaling over $900,000. Our investigation found that Mr. Wu wired money from several different foreign sources into three bank accounts maintained by or accessible to Mr. Tree. Tree then shuffled the money among six domestic accounts, four of which ultimately served as the source of a contribution to the DNC. The precise source of Tree's contributions cannot be established with certainty in most cases. However, in a few particular cases, which I would like to discuss today, the contributions can be connected with specific wire transfers. Overall, it appears to me that Mr. Tree relied upon Mr. Wu's foreign wire transfers to make his contributions to the DNC.
FBI agent Jerome Campaign has been working as a special investigator for the Senate committee. Under questioning from New Hampshire Senator Bob Smith, he unequivocally states that together with a woman named Keshi Zahn, Tree helped funnel foreign money into the Democratic National Committee.
In your opinion, did Mr. Tree launder money?
Yes, sir. In my opinion, he did.
How many visits did he have to the White House?
At least 23. I can't give you a specific number because it's the way records. It's not clear to me whether the times he was scheduled to appear and the times he actually showed up necessarily match up. But it's at least 23 times from January or February of 93 through the end of calendar year 96.
Over about a three-year period, 23 visits. Did your investigation disclose or uncover who, other than Mr. Middleton, Mr. Tree met with?
My investigation did not uncover who he met with at the White House. So,
by the way, Mark Middleton was a White House aide. What's clear is that Tree's longtime friendship with Governor and then President Clinton gave him a certain cachet, enough to keep the dollars flowing in from Asian investors like Mr. Wu, as well as to win a position with the International Trade Commission. In addition to the $200,000 to the DNC, Tree also donated $460,000 to Clinton's legal defense fund, money that was later returned. What isn't clear, though, is whether or not Tree was operating under orders from a foreign government. That's something the Republicans have been putting forward since the beginning of these hearings, and that's also something that Illinois Senator Richard Durbin emphasized during his questioning of Campaign, that wasn't proven.
It's true, is it not, that Mr. Tree is a U.S. citizen?
That is correct.
And as a U.S. citizen, he can make contributions to candidates and political committees. Is that not true?
That is correct.
In fact, he can make contributions from money that he has received from foreign bank accounts, can he not?
I'm not qualified to answer that. I don't want to say yes without knowing the...
Isn't that a big element here now, Mr. Campaign? I mean, that's really what it gets down to, doesn't it?
Sufficient knowledge of the campaign financing laws, like many Americans, in sufficient detail to answer your question.
Well, unfortunately, you've also said on the record he's guilty of laundering money, so I don't think you can have it both ways. Here is the element that I think is missing. I think Mr. Tree can make contributions to candidates and political committees and be perfectly legal. The question is whether he's being reimbursed for those contributions. And that, of course, requires some evidence of the involvement of Mr. Wu or others in sending money to him, what agreement was reached, and the like. What I'm trying to get to is this, Mr. Campaign. Before a jury's about to convict Mr. Tree for laundering, as you have today, wouldn't they need a little additional information beyond what you've gathered?
We would certainly hope so, Senator, but we don't have our investigation completed yet, and I tried to make very clear that our investigation is ongoing, and I would hope at some time to come back, perhaps, and give you a much better picture of Mr. Tree if he's not available otherwise to submit to an interview.
I agree with Senator Kaka. I hope he does make himself available, and I hope this government and this committee does everything in its power to bring him in here to answer. The information you brought before us today is very suspicious. It leads to the possibility of the conclusion that he has laundered money. I would not go as far as you've gone today based on what you've presented in saying that he has laundered money. I do also want to add here that I think this leap that many of my colleagues have made into a Chinese plot from this is still yet to be proven. For instance, the reference to CITIC, which was made before, the China International Trust and Investment Corporation, I take it that Mr. Wu had some connection with that company?
Mr. Wu is reported to have business ventures jointly with CITIC.
Yes, as does Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, Bechtel, Westinghouse, Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan, Morton Marietta, Hughes Space and Communications, and a raft of other major corporations in the United States, as does many of the leaders in both political parties. I won't recount them. I think we've done that before. I just hope that we hold ourselves to a strict standard of proof here and do not allow ourselves to be drawn into the innuendo that has been, at least in the press, about the so-called Chinese plot here. We have, I think, ample evidence that Mr. Tree went beyond the letter of the law. Whether or not he violated that law, I think, will require additional evidence, which I hope we can come up with. But those who want to make out of this a Chinese plot still have a lot of proof to bring to this committee.
That's Illinois Senator Richard Durbin. While there was no conclusive evidence that the Republicans are alleging of a link between Beijing and the White House, two women who acted as straw donors to the Democratic National Committee testified. Yu Chu and Ziping Wang both wrote checks to the DNC and were reimbursed by Tree the same day. The two women received immunity from criminal charges in exchange for their testimony. Majority Prosecutor Don Buckland, speaking through a translator, asked the women about a donation they made to the DNC. A friend of Charlie Tree's, Keshi Zahn, asked the women to sign checks to the DNC. The checks paid for a ticket to a DNC fundraiser for businessman Mr. Wu.
And you knew that that Keshi Zahn was writing the checks for a total of $20,000, did you not?
Yes.
Do you know what the DNC stands for?
您知不知道这个DNC?
Did you? No.
您当时知不知道 DNC 这三个字母是什么意思?
当时因为他写的时候我也没有去在意他这个字。No,
well, actually, at the time, I really didn't pay attention to her when she put down those three letters.
What did Ms. Keshi Zahn say to you when you handed at the time you were making these checks and handing them to her?
那么您写这几这两张支票交给她的时候，展展展克什小姐，她跟你说了什么？她没跟我说什么，她就是说帮老板买门票。
She really didn't say much except to say that this was going to be used to help the boss to buy a ticket.
And you understood by the boss, she meant Mr. Wu.
那么她说老板，你就知道她说的是吴先生是吧?
是的。
Yes.
Did she tell you that on February 19th and that evening there was a DNC-sponsored event at the Hay Adams Hotel for a dinner with President Clinton?
他有没有跟你说，就是在那天，也就是2月19号，民主党全国委员会 DNC 要在华盛顿的Hay Adams这个饭店要举行一个晚餐，由总统要出席，克林顿总统出席，他有没有讲？ No, she didn't say that.
Other than telling you that this was for a ticket for the boss, did Keshi Zahn explain to you or give you any explanation as to why she was asking you to make out these checks?
She really didn't give me any explanations.
Did you ask her for an explanation?
我当时我也没有，因为我只是想老板买门票帮他一下，我就这样做了。No,
not at the time, because all I thought was that I was going to help the boss to buy this ticket to pass the gate.
Today, the man who headed up President Clinton's legal defense fund, Michael Cardozo, is expected to testify before the committee. Democracy Now! Will be there, as we have been every day during the campaign finance abuse hearings, bringing you the latest reports. Feeling left out? Do you sometimes wonder what corporate executives, arms merchants, and bankers have that you don't?
I love coffee, I love tea.
Like coffees at the White House, for example. Maybe there's still hope for an invite. You can call our toll-free number and send the president a mug with a message. It says, Democracy Now! On one side, and Dear President Clinton, coffee, tea, and me. We send a letter with the mug that includes your name and address. Maybe you'll get that invite after all. Either way, the president will get the message. Call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230.
I love the Java Jive and it loves me.
Oh, and please, hold the Indonesian Java.
Tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
And we'll be back with Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A right-wing paramilitary group forced a human rights commission, including two UN delegates, to leave a region of northwest Colombia under threat of death, this according to church sources. The group was investigating reports of rights violations around the town of Vejía del Fuerte in Antioquia province, yes, on Monday, when it received a note signed by the so-called Peasant Self-Defense Group of Córdoba and Araba, the ACCU, the country's most feared death squad. The level of repression and violence hitting northwest Colombia's Afro-Colombian communities in Choco, bordering Panama, are at an all-time high. Analysts see several key points: the clear coordination between the paramilitary gunmen and the Colombian state security forces, also the commencement of destabilization operations and seizure of the increasingly valuable territory in Choco and Araba, where billion-dollar projects, including a transoceanic canal, Pan-American highway link, and high-speed railroad, is taking place by the Colombian business community, and increasing pressure by the military and regional authorities to oust Gloria Cuartas from her position as mayor and last remaining obstacle to the conquest by paramilitaries and army of Araba. We're joined now in our studio, Pacifica studio at WBAI, by two people. Gloria Cuartas joins us. She is mayor of Apartado, and I think I just pronounced that wrong. And Mario Murillo, who's public affairs director at Pacifica Station WBAI, who's just returned from another month-long trip to Colombia. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be on.
Well, Mario, why don't we begin with you before you translate for Gloria Cuartas. Tell us what you have found in your latest trip to Colombia in terms of the military and paramilitary repression and what the connection between those two groups is.
Well, just quickly, Carlos Perez is going to be translating for Gloria Cuartas, but let me just quickly, because there's so many things going on in Colombia right now. Just in a nutshell, we can first say that the level of the internal conflict, the war that the people in Colombia have been living for 40 years and more, is escalating to levels that we haven't seen in the last 10, 15 years. And as a result of that, of course, the insurgency war, spearheaded by two major armed insurgency organizations, the ELN, the National Liberation Army, and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, have led to, of course, a counterinsurgency strategy, which is directed by the Colombian military with considerable support by the United States, and which has also employed tactics which perhaps we can say are kind of irregular for this kind of insurgency, counterinsurgency operation, and that namely is, as you pointed out, the escalating use and the escalating growth of paramilitary forces throughout the country, particularly in the region that Gloria Cuartas represents. Apartado is the city. It's in Antioquia, the department or the province, and the region overall is known as Urabá, which covers a big territory where a lot of economic interests are at stake, and where paramilitary forces are conducting a dirty war against the civilian population, supposedly in the efforts to do away with the with the insurgents, insurgents, and what we've seen in Colombia in recent years, and I think one of the most alarming aspects of this whole situation is the high level of displacement. There's over 1 million internal refugees in Colombia right now as we speak, and the numbers are growing. A situation created primarily by the paramilitaries who go into communities, commit massacres, commit disappearances, commit major atrocities, and force families, children, mothers and elders to leave the communities, literally flee into the jungles, and then the paramilitaries repopulate the areas with their own supporters and their own people. This is a phenomenon which is getting out of control, and it's leading to a situation that doesn't seem to have any end in sight anytime soon.
Mario, what role does U.S. aid play, military or economic, in what's going on in the kind of violent picture of repression that you're describing?
Well, we have to point out, first of all, the statistics, the cold, hard statistics that exist in Colombia. Last year, and when I was in Colombia just a few weeks ago, the Colombian Commission of Jurors, perhaps the largest and one of the most important non-governmental human rights organizations in Colombia, released its study of human rights violations in 1996. And they pointed out that in that year, 1996, 3,600 people were killed in Colombia as a direct result of their political beliefs, politically motivated assassinations, massacres and killings. And just to put that in perspective, in the 17 years of the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile, a little less than 3,000 people were killed in a similar situation. So we're talking about in 1 year, more than 700 people more were killed in Colombia than in the 17 years of the dictatorship in Chile. The military, the U.S. military aid, there has been documentation from numerous human rights organizations, from America's Human Rights Watch Americas, from Amnesty International, in that points to the fact that this assistance that the United States is sending to Colombia in the name of the drug war, which is perhaps one of the most complicated reasons why it's hard to mobilize against the military role, the U.S. military role in Colombia, has been used by armed forces, the armed forces and sectors who have been linked with the paramilitary forces to commit these atrocities, these human rights abuses. And this is perhaps the most direct link, and it has been documented. Now, the one, I guess we can say, very light bit of optimism that perhaps we can see is that at least on a public level now, the State Department is beginning to talk about human rights more directly in Colombia, but there's still question as to why is this assistance, this over $100 million in fiscal year 1997, continues going down to Colombia in the name of the drug war.
You've been looking, Mario Murillo, at a particular party in Colombia, a left-wing party that has been particularly hard hit by military and paramilitary repression.
That's right. You're talking specifically about the Patriotic Union. Some of you may have seen, Amy, on last week in the New York Times, there was finally a pretty good report about the situation facing the Patriotic Union. Patriotic Union, of course, is a left-of-center, progressive party that was founded in 1985, basically trying to instill social change through the so-called political legal means as opposed to the armed insurrection that has been in Colombia for generations. And since 1985, over 3,000 militants and workers of the Patriotic Union from throughout the country, including presidential candidates, including senators, national congress members, grassroots activists, have been killed and or disappeared. And this is a situation which creates a major question as to the kind of democracy or so-called democracy that Colombia currently has, a country that has been priding itself as being the longest-standing democracy in Latin America, where a party like the Patriotic Union cannot conduct its affairs without the threats of massacres or annihilation or exile, which many Patriotic Union activists happen to be in right now.
We're talking to Mario Murillo, who is Public Affairs Director at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, who has just returned from more than a month trip to Colombia. He is working on a video that he's been working on for the last 4 years on what is going on in Colombia. We're going to go to Gloria Cuartas now, who is mayor of, is it Apartado?
Apartado, that's right.
Apartado. Maybe, Mario, you could set up the significance of this mayor.
Well, Gloria Cuartas is a strong a symbol of the resistance that continues to exist in Colombia in light of this scenario, which I just briefly kind of put a thumbnail sketch on. She has been the mayor of Apartado. She has been an outspoken critic of this violence, spearheaded by the military and of course the paramilitaries, and more particularly having a comprehensive approach in dealing with the economic interests that are at stake in the region, which she represents, economic interests that are directly, we can say, directly and indirectly responsible for a lot of the violence that we see unfolding in Colombia. And she's been the target of attacks, public attacks from people in the press in Colombia, and she's also been the target of direct attempts on her life and her person. But despite that, she has maintained a very strong will to first of all, for example, not even to refuse taking bodyguards to protect her person, saying that, no, I'm part of the community, and this is unnecessary. There's no reason why people should live in this situation. But I would prefer Gloria talk about that herself.
Gloria Cuartas, let me ask you why you refuse to have bodyguards in this very violent area of Colombia, meaning a serious target of repression by the military and paramilitaries.
Primero, quiero agradecer la oportunidad de estar con ustedes y agradecer a la red
like
de solidaridad
de
los Estados Unidos con Colombia,
US,
porque nos han acompañado. Creo que cuando somos elegidos
popularmente,
cuando tenemos la posibilidad de estar frente a un país que tiene una constitución para la paz,
nosotros los
alcaldes no podemos llegar a la función
we have the
de estar acompañando duty a nuestro pueblo
Being with our people
de por medio una violación a los derechos humanos.
When there are human rights violations.
Personalmente pienso que estar armado
Personally, I think that being armed means
to
worsen the conflict.
Sola,
and I am rather,
solo con
I'm rather alone, alone with my driver.
Creo que no
and
estoy
I believe that I am not
amenaza.
Generating any threat.
Con
that
esto
way.
Estoy de alguna manera diciéndole al pueblo
so
que
in this
yo
way,
corro
I'm telling,
la suerte
I'm telling people.
Corre.
That I run the same fate as they.
Hmm. Gloria Cuartas, what do you see as the greatest threats to democracy in your area in Northwest Colombia? What prevents democracy from taking hold?
Creo que en estos tres años de gobierno,
in these 3 years in government,
tenemos 1,200 personas asesinadas,
people murdered. We've had
300 personas procesos de reinserción.
300 people have been processed.
Y posteriormente los candidatos
and
y simpatizantes
candidates
de la Unión Patriótica
and, sympathizers of the UP were assassinated. In my jurisdiction.
20,000
so we have 20,000 hectares partially unoccupied. 2,000 families that have had to abandon their land.
Una comunidad rural
a rural community
San
called
José
San José
de Apartado,
San José de Apartado,
donde estamos buscando que la comunidad internacional
where we're looking for international help
logre que el gobierno
in getting the government to
y la guerrilla
and the guerrillas
comprendan que no podemos seguir en esta confrontación de sangre.
Getting them to understand that we cannot continue this bloodbath.
Y pienso que
Colombia
hoy está viviendo un conflicto interno que no quiere que la comunidad internacional,
it does not wish the international community to know, especially
los Estados Unidos,
the United States,
que apoya al ejército
which,
colombiano,
supports the Colombian army,
las organizaciones de derechos humanos,
the human, and human rights organizations,
los congresistas,
congressmen,
deben entender que ya América Latina no puede seguir
must understand that Latin America can no longer
forzando el desarrollo
forced development
a partir de la de impedir que la gente se exprese libremente
cannot, force development by preventing people from expressing themselves freely
y hacer libre and, ejercicio de la vida política
and let us be freely engaged in politics.
Por esto pienso que estar hoy frente a ustedes, los
today,
oyentes,
in your audience, with your audience,
tiene que sensibilizarnos para que las mujeres
must sensibilize us women
los hombres,
men,
los ancianos, los niños,
and children,
los empresarios,
a businessman,
comprendan que una región productora
that
de banano,
understand that a region that produces, banana,
como Urabá,
as much as Urabá,
que todos los días llega a su mesa un banano,
where the people who, to whose table a banana is eaten every day.
Es necesario que comprendamos
we must all understand
que estas negociaciones internacionales de mercado,
these international market negotiations,
como mínimo nos deben ayudar
us,
para que el desarrollo en América
so
Latina
development in Latin America
recupere una dimensión a
may,
escala humana.
May recuperate a human dimension.
Y el desarrollo es posible,
and development is possible,
pero no bajo la degradación
but not under the degradation
y la agudización de un conflicto
and
armado.
The worsening of an armed conflict.
Gloria Cuartas, as mayor of Apartado, what about your vulnerability as a woman? Do you see yourself more or less vulnerable because you are a woman and a political activist?
Desde el año 1995,
since 1995,
que tuve la oportunidad de llegar por un acuerdo político,
to reach through political accord,
experimenté que era una oportunidad
well,
que tenía para
mitigar
el conflicto. El tema de los derechos humanos no se
discutía.
Y nosotros empezamos con las mujeres, los ancianos, los indígenas, los negros.
And we began with women, the elderly, indigenous peoples and blacks.
A rodearnos para no hacer parte de la actitud contestataria del conflicto armado.
We began to get together so that we do not join the same logic as the armed conflict.
Yo he recibido amenazas de la guerrilla y de los paramilitares.
By the guerrilla and the paramilitaries.
He recibido por parte del ejército
I've
colombiano
been, by the army,
la 17ª brigada en el
17th
Urabá,
brigade in Urabá.
La instalación de una demanda penal.
They have sued me.
Asumiendo que me acusaban de rebelión.
Having, accusing me of rebellion.
Y duró un año la investigación.
And the investigation lasted for a year.
Para luego encontrar que no había méritos para abrir tal demanda.
After which they found that there was no cause for this.
Luego se hizo
action.
Una movilización por parte del ejército con algunos sindicalistas.
There was a mobilization
para
by the
que
army.
Abandonara la región. Como una manera, porque se argumentaba
to,
que el
region,
solo hecho de estar viajando a Europa o a los Estados Unidos a
Europe,
pedir solidaridad para Colombia
to asking solidarity for Colombia
era una manera
was,
de preparar un boicot para los
boycott,
inversionistas extranjeros
hurt,
o colombianos.
Foreign, investors in Colombia.
Y creo que
and I believe that,
de cara al siglo XXI
in the light of the 20th century, 21st
lo que tenemos
century,
que buscar es que los ciudadanos seamos socios del desarrollo
for citizens,
y no
become partners
usuarios del
in
desarrollo.
And not just users of development.
Por esto pienso que
that is
he
why
recibido
I think
muchas
that
amenazas.
I have, been threatened a lot.
Estoy perseguida.
I am persecuted.
Pero Colombia es mi país.
But Colombia is my country.
Apartado es mi pueblo.
Apartado is my town.
Y voy a continuar porque creo
continue,
que las dificultades
the
nos tienen que fortalecer.
Must make us stronger.
Y todavía en el mundo queda gente con sensibilidad.
And there are still people with
y
sensibility
esa utopía
in the world.
La estamos construyendo.
And we are
por
building that,
that
human rights utopia we are still building.
Do you have any faith in the peace process, at least the request by President Samper to begin negotiations with the FARC, with the Colombian guerrillas? Do you think anything productive will come out of that? Will there be any real change in Colombia?
Creo personalmente que Colombia por estos días
I personally think that these days
tiene una radicalización
Colombia has been radicalized,
y agudización del conflicto armado.
And the armed conflict has become, more acute.
La aparición de los paramilitares, de las convivir,
the emergence of paramilitaries and convivir,
como grupos de justicia privada que contrata el gobierno,
as private justice groups contracted out by the
muestran
government,
muestran que el panorama tiene sus grandes dificultades.
Shows that there's great difficulties in
pero al mismo
ahead.
Tiempo, la postura del general, perdón, del ministro de la Defensa,
but at the same time,
cuando se habla de la presentación de una propuesta de paz permanente,
the defense minister's position,
empieza a crear un ambiente.
Is creating an atmosphere.
Yo tengo fe en que así nos demoremos, se tiene que construir con la comunidad internacional
y con esfuerzos nacionales
una salida negociada al conflicto armado en Colombia.
Exit out of the
es un trabajo largo,
it is
pero
a long-term
yo creo que estamos
job,
intentando.
But I think that we're trying.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Actually, all three of you. Gloria Cuartas, mayor of Apartadó. Mario Murillo, public affairs director at WBAI Pacifica Radio, just returned from Colombia. And thank you, Carlos Perez, for translating for the mayor. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, we're going to take a look at an international crisis. It's the issue of landmines. Stay with us. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm looking at a full-page ad in the New York Times today. Its headline, "Landmines caused more U.S. casualties in Vietnam than any other weapon." There's a large photograph of a wounded soldier being carried out by other soldiers, and it says, "Let's not let history repeat itself." U.S. Defense Department documents reveal that landmines killed or injured more American troops during the Vietnam War than any other weapon. Joining us right now to talk about this report that has just come out to weigh in the landmine ban controversy, our two guests in our Washington studio. Steve Goose is with us. He's program director of the Human Rights Watch Arms Project and chair of the steering committee of the U.S. campaign to ban landmines. We're also joined by retired Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who served the U.S. in combat in both Korea and Vietnam. He's now president of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Happy to join you.
Well, is this new news, Lieutenant General Gard?
It's not new news to the people who served in Vietnam. A very high proportion of our casualties were caused by anti-personnel landmines. And what that ad is getting at is the fact that it was our landmines that the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese used against us.
Did you know this all along?
We were quite well aware of it when we were in Vietnam.
Yet why has it been so many years since the public is now learning about this?
Well, I just don't think there's been a general interest in how the casualties were caused. Everyone's aware of the number, but they weren't aware of how they were brought about.
Steve Goose, tell us about how you got the Pentagon documents that show how many American soldiers were killed or maimed in Vietnam and Korean War by U.S. landmines.
As General Gard said, these numbers have been around for a long time, although there hasn't been much public awareness of them. This report is largely based on a 1972 set of documents, a series of 15 different documents that were put together by the people who had to fight with and against landmines in the Vietnam War and in the Korean War. It's particularly relevant now, though, because we have an intense debate going on in the United States about what it should do with its landmines policy, whether it should stay the course with its current policy, which is to promote the notion of a ban, but to move towards it at a very slow pace, at the Pentagon's own pace, versus joining an international effort led by Canada, which will produce a comprehensive ban on all anti-personnel landmines in December of this year. In the course of this debate, the Pentagon is saying we can't move that quickly. Landmines continue to be important to us, and they offer up a series of arguments, all of which I think are undermined by their own words presented in this report.
Who is the one who makes the decision on this?
Well, ultimately, it has to be President Clinton.
And
he's the
commander-in-chief.
What has he said? He seems to be personally sympathetic to the notion of a ban. He, back in 1994, was the first global leader to call for the eventual elimination of anti-personnel landmines. But eventual has turned out to be the operative word, not elimination, as he continues to defer to the Pentagon's timetable.
And what exactly, Lieutenant General Robert Gard, is the Pentagon's timetable? When they say eventual, what do they mean?
Well, I think the Pentagon would be reluctant to give them up at all, because it's very difficult for people responsible for combat operations and the defense of our soldiers and sailors and airmen to give up any weapon, however marginal, that may save the life of an American soldier. So the Pentagon is opposed to giving up the landmines. The president, on the other hand, has declared that since that initial declaration of eventually banning them, he since said he wants to negotiate an international treaty as quickly as possible. But that's his that's not his action policy. That's his declarative policy.
But you say the Pentagon is saying they don't want to get rid of any weapon that could protect a U.S. soldier. But as you point out from these Pentagon documents that Human Rights Watch and the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation have now publicized, that U.S. soldiers are being killed by these landmines at an incredible rate. I mean, I think in the Vietnam War, what's the figure? 64,000 U.S. soldiers.
64,000 casualties caused by landmines. And that's probably an underestimate, because there are other categories that include fragmentation, and the landmine might not have gotten the credit it deserves. This was particularly true in the area in which I served, in the Delta. I would say well over half of our casualties were caused by landmines.
Are the U.S. corporations that make the landmines a factor here? Are they lobbying against the ban? Steve Goose?
Not in any significant way. I think, in fact, one of the reasons why the international campaign to ban landmines has had so much success, why we have more than 100 countries who've already pledged to sign this ban treaty in December, is because landmines aren't a high profit enterprise. That's true here in the U.S. as well as around the world. Human Rights Watch a few months ago put out a document identifying 48 companies in the U.S. that have produced anti-personnel landmines at some point in time. In the course of engaging in a dialogue with those 48 companies, we asked them to get out of the business, and 17 of them have done so. If there was a high profit factor, they wouldn't have done so. But
Which is the largest corporation that currently makes landmines?
The most significant company in the U.S. is Alliant Tech Systems, which is based in Hopkins, Minnesota.
Right now, how are you organizing this coalition of groups? I mean, the full-page piece in the Times from your group, Human Rights Watch, the Arms Project, and Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, you've got some powerful allies that people don't usually think of would be interested in banning weapons. You even have the six senators who served in Vietnam all calling for this ban.
Since there's a piece of legislation that has been introduced by Senator Leahy and Senator Hagel, that has 60 co-sponsors with a large number of Republicans, bipartisan support, that calls for a permanent ban on use of anti-personnel landmines by the U.S. by the year 2000. That kind of support has made the Pentagon extremely nervous, and they have come out firing full blast.
Who in the Pentagon, Lieutenant General Robert Gard, is the fiercest proponent of not having this ban?
Well, it's hard to say. The way the Pentagon is organized, there's input into the various staff agencies. In a case such as this, it would come up to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is essentially a spokesman for the field commanders and for the various service chiefs. And they take a position. But that doesn't mean that military considerations should always be overriding. Our founding fathers placed the commander-in-chief function into an elected civilian official, the President of the United States. And when one agency advocates a position, it's up to the president to resolve the disagreements.
I mean, the Secretary of the Secretary of Defense is also a civilian, Senator Cohen, formerly a senator. What does he feel?
Well, and here's an example. Senator Cohen supported Senator Leahy in all of the previous initiatives, but now that he is in charge of the Department of Defense, he feels an obligation to be a spokesman for his own agency. And that's the way our government works. This is so similar to the process that took place in 1925 when we banned chemical warfare. We had presidents all the way from Harding through FDR that supported that ban against the very strong objections of what we then called the War Department, who felt that the weapon was absolutely indispensable. Decisive, couldn't possibly give it up. It's going to be used in war anyway. And we all know now that after that convention, the chemical weapon became stigmatized, and in fact, it's been used very infrequently. Somebody estimated in 4 out of 400 conflicts that have occurred since 1925.
Has the Pentagon ever seen a weapon it didn't like?
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. It isn't so much that they like them. It is that we in the military are brought up on the thesis that our job is to defeat the enemy's armed force in the shortest time possible with the fewest possible friendly casualties. Humanitarian considerations are not irrelevant, but by no means are they given the same currency as the warfighting capability. So in that sense, we probably haven't seen a weapon we didn't like.
Retired Lieutenant General Robert Gard is the president of the Monterey Institute of International Studies and served in combat in Vietnam and Korea. Steve Goose, program director of the Human Rights Watch Arms Project, you had something you wanted to add there.
Yeah. Clearly, it is the Pentagon's opposition to moving quickly on a ban that is the problem, and that President Clinton must make the decision to override objections of some in the Pentagon. But it's important to realize, and this is one of the purposes of this report that has just been released, is that there is not unanimity of views within the military establishment on the utility of anti-personnel landmines. This report points out quite clearly that many of our military leaders during the Korean War, many of our military leaders during the Vietnam War, thought that these weapons made us pay a greater cost than the value that they provided to our military. We see the dissent over the usefulness of anti-personnel landmines continuing through to today. General Gard was one of 15 of our most senior retired military officers who sent a letter to President Clinton about 1 year ago that was reprinted in a full-page ad in the New York Times that told him that an immediate ban on anti-personnel landmines was both humane but also militarily responsible, and that it would not affect the safety of our forces or those of our allies. Others who signed that letter to the president included General Schwarzkopf, the commander of Desert Storm, General Jones, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, two of the commanders who used to command our forces in Korea. So we see quite clearly that there is that there are dissenting views, both within the active duty military and within the retired military, about just how useful these weapons are.
The Canadian government is leading the call for the moratorium on production and use of landmines.
Canada is one of the key governments that has moved this process forward. It's because they launched it last October. It's usually referred to as the Ottawa process. A treaty has been developed. There have been three different international meetings to discuss the elements of this treaty. It will be negotiated in Oslo the first 3 weeks in September and will be signed in December of this year. As I indicated before, more than 100 nations have now pledged to go to these negotiations and to keep within the December timeframe. Those 100 nations include virtually all of our European allies. The UK, France, Germany, Italy are all on board. The U.S. is really isolated on this issue.
General Guard, in the New York Times, they quote the Pentagon saying that landmines are particularly needed in South Korea, where American mines are seen as a critical defense against an invasion from the north. You served in Korea. What do you think of that argument?
Well, of course, in Korea, in the early stages, the war was very fluid. Now, as you know, there's a demilitarized zone. The problem, as it's seen by some responsible for the defense of South Korea, is that the North Koreans are poised right on the demilitarized zone with troops ready to go. And those that plan the defense have made extensive use of mines to combat any possible invasion. And so the claim is that if you take the mines away from us, the enemy will be able to reach Seoul much more quickly and we will have far more casualties. The problem with that is that most of the war games that are used to make that point hold everything else just as it is. No compensatory action is taken. You simply take the current situation, make some assumptions that really favor the offense by the North Koreans, remove the mines, and then, sure, that's the result you get. On the other hand, there are compensatory things you could do to substitute for the mines in terms of greater firepower, sensors, and the rest. Because the idea is, doesn't matter how you stop them, whether it's with a landmine or with direct fire of tanks or from the air or however it's done. It's probably the best case the military can make. And Senator Leahy's legislation provides an option for the president to report annually that these mines are still essential to the defense of South Korea. Now, in fact, I don't believe they are. Neither does retired General Jim Hollingsworth, whose responsibility it was to design the defense of South Korea after the demilitarized zone was put in. But nevertheless, Senator Leahy has been willing in his proposed legislation to make provisions to allow an exception for Korea in the short term.
Right now, since the negotiations are going to take place in September, as you said, in Oslo, what are you recommending, Steve Goose, that if people want to get involved in this process, if people want to have a say in whether landmines should be banned in the world, at least in this country, whether they should be banned for production here, what can they do?
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, the U.S. is on the verge of making a decision about whether or not to join the Ottawa process. We expect that decision any day. It was supposed to be made by the end of this month, so we expect it either this week or early next week. Now's the time to write to the president, to call the White House, and let him know that it's his responsibility to move this process forward and to put the U.S. on the right track.
And if people want to get a hold of Human Rights Watch Arms Project's report on landmines, where can they call?
They can call either our Washington office, which is 202-371-6592, or they can call our publications department in our New York office.
That's 202-371-6592. And I also see at the bottom of the ad in the New York Times that Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation have a website if you want to get more information. And that website is www.vvaf.org. That's www.vvaf.org. I want to thank you both very much for joining us, retired General Robert Guard and Steve Goose of Human Rights Watch Arms Project, for being with us this morning. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Fuff Vollmeyer, Janice K. Bryant, and Leslie George. Our engineer in New York is Errol Maitland. In Washington, it's Andy York. Our executive producer is Julie Drizin. If you want a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. 3 hours.